So I'm talking this morning with Richard Florida, who is the director of the Martin Prosperity Institute and the Ruttman School of Management at the University of Toronto. He's written many books, including The Rise of the Creative Class and Who's Your City? And his wonderful new book is The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. So welcome, Richard. And
great to be with you.
Tell us, what is The Great Reset?
Well, you know, as soon as the economic and financial crisis hit, I thought it would be important to look back in history at analogous events. So the Great Depression of 1929 and the 1930s, and then the Panic and Long Depression of 1873 that continued for a couple of decades. And I wanted to see not only where crises come from. I think there's been a lot of very, very, very good and cogent analysis of what causes crises. I was more interested in how this process of moving from crisis to recovery comes about. So what I discovered is that we have several explanations, which are in the main very thoughtful and very helpful. I mean, one that kind of captures the popular imagination is that spending, government spending to stimulate demands, called this the Keynesian approach, is really important, and obviously that was important in recovery from the Great Depression. The 30s. The second one is that technological innovations matter a lot. And actually, looking back at these two previous crises, one of the main things I was able to find is significant confirmation for this Schumpeterian, associated with Joseph Schumpeter, hypothesis that what gets us out of crises is these moments of creative destruction where we invent new technologies, new entrepreneurs, bring them to the fore, and new industries are created and old ones die off. But what I was able to find is that recoveries are actually, there's more at work than just those two things. It's not just simple technological innovations that matter. And great work by Alexander Field and others show that the 1930s and then the 1870s and 80s were the most innovative decades of the past couple of centuries. But it's not just individual technological innovations that matter. It's the rise of what economic historians call systems of innovation, the rise of electric power in the 1880s and 90s, the rise of the streetcars and then the cable cars and subway systems, the rise of the whole automotive transportation system and its kind of perfection or further development in the 1930s, later the interstate highway system after the war. And then finally, I think there was one big neglected factor that I found is actually paramount, as important as any of, or even more important than any of the others, and that is the rise of what geographers, including a geographer named David Harvey, call a spatial fix, a kind of abstract term for basically a new way of living and working and a new economic geography. So what powered recovery, or helped power recovery from that long depression of the 1870s and 80s, was the movement of people from an agricultural economy and small agricultural centers, and actually very small by today's standards, cities, to massive industrial centers. Obviously, a burgeoning New York City, Chicago just grows astoundingly, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and then even more, you know, more in modern memory and etched in the modern historical eye, it was not just defense spending, it was not just Keynesian spending, it was not just innovation that powered recovery from the Great Depression, it really was the rise of the suburban way of living. And I think that's a really good example of a great reset. The rise of suburbia, the subsidies, the government incentives for the purchase of suburban homes, the construction of urban and suburban infrastructure, roads, sewers, water pipes, that's really laid the foundation for recovery after the Great Depression. And it was those suburban homes that created the demand. You know, you needed to have appliances, refrigerators, washers, dryers, television sets, two television sets, three television sets, a car, a second car, a third car. So it really primed the pump in effect for the industrial machine. So great resets are not just technological innovations. They're not just periods of government spending. They're really the invention of whole new ways and whole new geographies of living and working.
Right. And this spatial fix, the Great Reset is a great resettle. As I read your book, it's about moving into denser urban areas with more walking and biking and public transport and much less driving. Are we ready for this?
I'm amazed. You know, and I'm sitting here when we're talking today in my home in Toronto, with the G8 going on not far from here and the G20 about to begin in the city of Toronto. And as far as I can tell, there is absolutely no conversation among national leaders, economic leaders, central bank heads, treasury and finance ministers. There's absolutely no conversation about this aspect of our great reset and the way we're going to move towards recovery and a future prosperity. Oh, they're talking about continuing to bail out the banks. Oh, perhaps now the need to balance budgets, or, you know, President Obama is saying, well, that can wait. We need to continue to spend government money to forestall the worst aspects of this crisis. And all of those short-term measures are very important. But I think, you know, in the book, I kind of point to President Obama's advisor, Rahm Emanuel, who says, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste.
Right.
Well, then don't waste it. And I think we are wasting it. And this is exactly the moment we have to keep our eyes not only on the short term,
right,
but on the long term, and invest in ways that will ensure that Americans and Canadians and others around Europe and the world can achieve a lasting prosperity. So one of the things I was able to think through in the Great Reset is that it takes public and private investments for these great resets, these facial fixes, or these great resettles, and that's exactly the title of a chapter, these great resettles to come about. And what we are going through in this Great Reset is a slow but inexorable change. Again, and it's as millions and millions of people reset our own individual lives, as we say no to that big, giant suburban house, as empty nesters trade in that big McMansion and move to a smaller condominium closer to town. It could be in a suburban town center. It could be in a rural village. It can be closer to the city core. But what we're finding is the rise of a whole new kind of economic unit, which I call the rise of the mega region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not only a city and its suburbs, but that's an entire economic corridor, like the great corridor that stretches from Boston through New York to Washington, D.C. And what's happening is that entire corridor is becoming more packed and denser. And in fact, what the industrial city was to the 1890s, what the suburban America was to the 1950s and 60s, these new mega regions, these, you know, gigantic units with 50 million people and trillions of dollars in economic output out to our time, and I think our political leaders are not really thinking through clearly, or perhaps at all, what it would mean to really create a new economic geography, a new way of living and working that would really stimulate our economy. To make this very short, we're not going to grow an economy of the future if we continue to spend all of our money, and the most recent data out just yesterday shows that Americans continue to spend more than 50% of their income on housing. Now, add in the cost of cars and energy, add in the costs of food and the basics, healthcare. What's left over to support the growth of new technology industries, new experience-based industries, new knowledge-based industries, to leftover money to develop our people, to invest in their education and human capital and skill development? Nothing. And so we have to get past our addiction to housing and cars and this old order of what we call Fordism. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to spend a lot less on housing and cars. We're going to need a different kind of infrastructure in order to grow these industries and technologies of the future.
I mean, what your book points out wonderfully is that these things link together. I mean, one reason why the politicians are focused on the sort of nostalgia and taking the financial system back to where we could finance more cars and houses is that we have this addiction. We have this, and we need a consumption fix. But I don't get all that much, don't see much evidence of people ready, in a sense, to ditch their homes and their cars and to shake off this addiction. How will this happen? Is this one of the more difficult parts of the agenda that needs to be dealt with?
Well, I think we are addicted to debt. I mean, what the bubble really was a way of using debt. I quote a fellow in the book saying, you know, debt is capitalism's dirty little secret.
Right.
I think one of the things the bubble did was it allowed debt to fuel that consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, it created the illusion that the house was an investment and that could, you know, capital could be extracted using the house as an ATM mm-hmm. to fuel current consumption. Well, the end of the bubble solved all of that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think that politicians get it. No, I don't think that most business leaders get it. But what I think is happening is what's happened before, that these great resets take a long time, mm-hmm. and that they unfold in phases. Mm-hmm. And we may be moving from the very early first phase of, oh, my God, it's a crisis. It's not going away. You know, government spending is not going to make this better. It is quite clear to almost every sentient observer that we are now heading for a double-dip recession, right. that the housing market that was being massively underwritten by the U.S. federal government is now beginning to falter again, that we have a very nasty and pernicious crisis in the Eurozone, that the United Kingdom and even the United States have perhaps over the long run unsustainable deficits, and that we're looking at a house of cards. And, you know, this happened in the Great Depression. There were all sorts of pronouncements that things are getting better, we're going to be out of it in another year, the economy is improving, the stock market looks up. Well, that was a 25-year cycle, and so was the crisis of 1873. It was about 2.5 to 3 decades before the economy really got better. I tell the story in the book about my father. Mm-hmm. My father was 8 years old when the markets crashed in 1929. He was 1934. He was 13. He took a job in a factory. He went off to fight in World War II, and when he came back, he moved back to Newark, New Jersey. It was only in 1960, as a nearly 40-year-old man, this 8-year-old boy who saw the crash at 8, was nearly 40 when he was able to buy a home with my mom and be part of that American golden moment and American dream. So great resets take a long time, and I think what's happening is that people slowly but surely begin to adjust. People begin to look at that spending on a house and say, you know, I can't go in over my head. That McMansion, which I thought was going to make me happy, doesn't. What I see young people talking about, the young people I talk to, is they don't want to buy a house. They know that that house is what's going to put them in extreme debt, and it's going to, instead of freeing them, giving them autonomy, it might enslave them. They're saying no to buying cars. I mean, I grew up in, you know, North American, United States car culture. Young people today are saying no thank you to a car. I'd rather live close to work, buy a bicycle or a scooter, or commute. And so these changes build up very, very slowly. And I think over time, and in ways that operate kind of behind the backs and over the heads of people, very slowly but surely a new way of life begins to emerge. And what I've tried to say in the Great Reset is, no, I don't have a crystal ball. No, I'm not a future forecaster. I'm not an omniscient or a clairvoyant. But these trends are emerging in our society. And, you know, just today, the census report came out that said urban areas are continuing to grow. Suburban areas and Sunbelt cities, growth is slowing and in many declining for the first time in modern memory. So there are shifts that we can see beginning to accumulate, beginning to add up, that if we can begin to lever them, and I think what the book is really about is saying to political and economic leadership, wake up. If we're smart about this, and we have a lot more tools at our disposal, and we look at the long run, we could shrink the time it takes to recover so we don't have to be 2 or 3 decades to move from crisis to reset to recovery. We could shrink that time to a decade or so. And my hope in writing the book is that our political and economic leadership will wake up and really take a look at what it's going to take to shift our economy from that old housing and car and energy, and never mind the Gulf oil spill, which should be enough alone a wake-up call, from that housing, car, and energy complex to shrinking that down, to making, of course, our people are well-housed and housing is affordable and people can get where they need to go, but making sure that people aren't spending all of their money and our economy isn't spending all of its precious capital on those things, that there's enough money left over or there's enough capital freed up to invest in skill development, human capital development, development of the real economy, the development of new innovative industries, and the development of a better way of life. So I think that's where we have to head, and hopefully the book can serve as that kind of a wake-up call.
Right. I mean, the phrase that you have, the housing auto complex, is a wonderful, wonderful phrase. We heard about the military-industrial complex, and maybe the housing auto complex is even more difficult to deal with. And we talked about a need for a spatial fix, a need for a consumption fix, a need for a financial fix. In the book, you also allude to a couple of other fixes. We need a management fix. We need management that creates more new and good jobs that are innovative and productive and higher paying. We need an education fix, an education system that's in sync with this new creative economy, and a social compact fix with general health care and a safety net for all. I mean, So it's, I mean, it's a fairly hefty agenda that you're putting in front of us here.
But every great reset has done this. And I think one of the things the book points to, and two of those things which are very important to me, is that every great reset gives rise to new kinds of jobs. So in the first great reset in the 1870s, we could not imagine an economy that the majority of Americans and people around the world didn't live on farms. How are we going to survive when the farms shut down? More than 50% of our workforce worked on farms. Well, today it's less than 1%, and we still eat, and people still work. We couldn't understand what was going to happen to people after the Great Depression. We were moving into an era, in the words of the great Alvin Hansen, Harvard economist, Roosevelt advisor, of secular stagnation, that the economy, the productive forces of society had run out. There was no new source of productivity and innovation and growth. Government would have to fill in and create jobs for the remainder of human history. Secular stagnation, but we created a huge number of high-paying jobs for people like my dad, working in a factory. What we're saying, we have the same argument today. The American job machine has run out of gas. All of those good blue-collar jobs like my father had and people in Pittsburgh where I live and Detroit where my wife is from, those jobs are gone forever, and we're doomed. There will be a small minority of people who work in high-skill, high-wage jobs, but the rest of us are doomed to low-wage employment. How did we get here? And how did we forget, and that's what the book says, that we made manufacturing work good jobs? My father told me this story. He took his job in a factory in 1934. He was 13 years old. It took nine people to make a living wage. He went off to World War II, and he came back at the end of the 1940s. He went back to work in the same factory. He had a great job. He had benefits. He had health care. He had high wages. He could save his money, buy a house, and put his three boys to college. The same job. That was a bad job. We made a good job. And so what the book is saying is, yes, we are going to create another 7 million new jobs in high-skill knowledge and professional work. We're growing those jobs like crazy, and we have to do more to support them. We're going to lose manufacturing work. That work is being offshored and routinized and made more efficient and technology upgraded, but we're going to create another 7 to 8 million new jobs in low-wage service works, food preparation, home health care aides, personal care aides, restaurant work, dry cleaning, hair cutting. And what the book says is that we need an agenda to make those jobs good jobs. If I had to say if there's one key thing our government has to do, it has to have a real jobs agenda. Mm-hmm. It has to make sure that every single job we create and every single job, 60 million Americans work in the low-wage service industry. That's not the knowledge jobs. That's 45% of our workforce. We're going to create another 7 or 8 million. We've got to turn those jobs into good jobs. And in the book, I say it clearly. All we need to do is apply what we learned in manufacturing over the course of the 1980s when we responded to competitive threats from Japan and other countries. We implement quality circles, continuous improvement, get service workers to be innovative, to work in teams, to increase productivity. And since I wrote the book, I had this great conversation on a radio program with a caller who was from Ohio. He spent his entire life working on manufacturing quality improvement, supply chain management, and making companies better performing. He said one day he thought, what if I go work with some of the local service businesses in my town in Ohio? What if I go work with some of the nonprofits and private service companies? He said to me, Richard, I have never seen less well-managed operations. They had no clue about business planning and marketing and quality control and engaging workers in continuous improvement. He said, we can do such little things. There was such low-hanging fruit to make those companies incredibly more efficient. When they're more efficient, they can pay their workers better. And they can upgrade not only their service, but upgrade their workforce. Well, we need a summit tomorrow to create a service jobs and agenda for good jobs in this country. We can't accept the fact that 60 million Americans and millions upon millions of more are condemned to a low-wage future. We've made manufacturing good jobs in the past. We got to make the jobs we're creating today good jobs for the future.
One final question. Suppose the G8 calls you up this afternoon and says, look, Richard, we've been reading your book and we all love it. What can we do? What are the three top things that we should do in order to accelerate the Great Reset?
Stop propping up the housing market and take those foreclosures, those empty condos, what a tragedy. Turn them into affordable rental housing for people who need it around the world. Get the folks that have to get out from under underwater mortgages, take those houses off their hands, let them rent them back or let them move to opportunity, number one. Number two, we need a massive agenda to upgrade jobs now. We need a global summit on how to make service jobs the good jobs of the future, to take them from the $20,000 or even $30,000 a year jobs to family-supporting jobs, and to make sure those out-of-place manufacturing workers have some form of employment insurance or wage supplement so they're willing to take a job in a service company. They're willing to get more back engaged in working, and that's going to get them back on a keel to a better psychology and a better attitude. And third, for the long haul, we have to reinvent our education system. We have got to create an education system that no longer squelches the creativity of our kids and turns out docile workers that were right for the farm or the assembly line, that turns out entrepreneurs. Every single school should be an entrepreneurial creative incubator. We need to, as a first principle, we need to recognize that our people are our biggest assets, the only real capital we have, that every single human being is a creative, innovative, and entrepreneurial asset that needs the right investment from early childhood education right on through adulthood and continuous learning. And then if I got to add one fourth bullet,
right,
we need a physical infrastructure for a knowledge economy. We have to get away from our addiction to roads and energy. We have to encourage people to be able to live closer to where they work. We need to understand that people no longer have to march into an office like they marched into a factory from 9 to 5. We need to connect our cities, especially our dying and declining Rust Belt cities. The best way to help out Detroit and Cleveland and Buffalo and Rochester and Toledo and Akron is to connect them to the thriving hub cities in their region and in other regions. Connect them to Chicago, high-speed rail from Chicago through Detroit, through Cleveland, Buffalo, over to Toronto, down to New York City. Make a high-speed. The Chinese are doing it. They're investing to connect their great mega regions. We need to do it too. So I think those are the things I tell the G8 or G20 leaders. And hopefully, you know, we, as I said, we're just moving from the first to second phase of this reset. Hopefully, as we get through the worst of it, as we stabilize our banking system, and as it becomes evident that we can't simply just reinvoke the past, I think as we move in the next couple of years, and for everyone listening, this is not going to be a quick fix. This is a long-run process. But as we move into the next couple of years, we can shift from trying to remake the past to trying to build a better future. Hey, you know, the book says we've done it at least twice before and come out stronger and more resilient and more prosperous. My hope is that we can do it one more time.
Now, what I love about the book is that it does take this deep and broad look. It looks backwards. That we've been here before, we've been through these things before, and so many books on management and economics that have talk as though the world was born yesterday. This is a book that does take a deep historical perspective. It's sobering because it goes into the not just the surface problems that we're looking at, but the deeper forces which are driving society, and it's forward-looking and optimistic that we've come through this before. We are likely to come out of it healthier and wealthier than before. And with your help, we may be able to get there sooner.
Why, so, thank you. It's just been a pleasure being with you, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
The book is The Great Reset, How New Ways of Living and Working Drive Post-Crash Prosperity. Thanks very much.